Hi, my name is Juliet, and I'm the host for this podcast. I'm studying to be a rabbi, and in Judaism, there's a specific portion or reading, we call it the Parsha from the Torah, for every week of the year. And as we go through these readings week by week in order from the beginning of the Torah to the end, from the beginning of the Jewish year to the end, we analyze the stories and we comment on them. Of course, connecting them to real life, to contemporary life, is how these ancient stories come alive, which is one of my great passions as a rabbi. I hope you'll accompany me as I tell these stories of Torah and of my life and the lives of others. If you miss an episode, you can always go back and find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for coming with me on this ancient and contemporary journey. And you can also make a donation, very welcome, on my website, lenegditamid.us. That's LNEGDITAMID.us, lenegditamid.us. These podcasts are free. I don't charge for them, but any contribution would be really welcome. So getting started with this week's episode. Deaf, blind, and dumb. That's actually a question. Deaf, blind, and dumb? Sorry about my voice here. This is about Shemini. And I want to start by saying, if you grew up in the U.S. educational system in the 60s and 70s, like I did, or beyond, or maybe even before, I don't really know, then when you learned about the amazing Helen Keller, it was from the book or the play, The Miracle Worker. You remember that? Maybe, maybe not. How can you not? It was all over the place. The movie, the book, the play, the book based on the play. Anyway, we were told she was completely cut off, that Helen Keller was completely cut off from the world until her teacher, Anne Sullivan, came along. And Helen Keller is described as and shown as violent and resistant to learning as a child. You remember that image, right? She's like, she runs away. She doesn't want to learn anything. She's fierce like a wild animal. And that's how it describes her, the blurb on the back of the book. She's a wild animal. I just was listening yesterday to this amazing podcast, The Experiment. You should look it up and listen. The Helen Keller Exorcism. I was like, whoa, that's a really good name. Exorcism. She the ghost? Yes, it's all about exorcising the ghost of Helen Keller. But for who? It's for this woman who's interviewed on the podcast, who grew up blind, who was also born with disabilities like Helen Keller's. Legally blind, deaf, not 100%. You know, with a lot of help, she was able to go to public schools and, you know, function and go take the subway by herself when she moved to New York City. And everybody compared her to Helen Keller as she was growing up. Like, oh, wow, you're so inspiring. And she hated this, which is really interesting to hear her story. But at one point in her life, she's forced to confront this, you know, to really learn about Helen Keller. It's a really crazy story. It's like she's in a coffee shop with her seeing eye dog, and her dog, you know, there, you know how sometimes there's a bookshelf with people leave books and you can take books, and there's a bookshelf there, and her dog actually goes over and noses the books, and he keeps nosing one particular book, and she's like, what are you doing? And finally she goes over, and he just keeps pushing at this book. And she takes the book off the shelf and she looks at it really closely because that's how she can see. And it's the book, The Miracle Worker, about Helen Keller, the same one that she read as a child that she hated. And anyway, she takes it home, and then she starts doing research at some point in her life. She's like, okay, I really need to find out more about this woman. And what she learns is that it's a completely false picture. This Helen Keller is a ghost. She's a myth. It's the myth of who she was, who she really was. And what she learns from Keller's own writing is that instead of being wild and uncontrollable, she had a very peaceful childhood, not at all cut off from the world before Sullivan comes into the picture. And in the end, you learn, I mean, you probably heard this already, that she became, that Helen Keller became this amazing public speaker. She became a vaudeville performer. She wrote over a dozen books, an incredibly accomplished woman. Yet she was also forced to conform as a woman of her time. And her true self was a very outspoken socialist and feminist, blaming the ills of women on marriage. She was a defender of people with disabilities. She was funny. That is, defending people of disabilities until she bought into the eugenics movement. And then, shockingly, she advocates only for children proven to have a good working brain of normal intelligence to be worthy of life. Like, she buys into this. It's incredible. And to the woman being interviewed, to this woman on the podcast, this was an immense disappointment to her. Like, how could she? And she just can't forgive her for this. Like, what? You're a horrible person. Even though Keller later changes her mind about eugenics, but it takes this woman a while to finally come to a place of understanding of how Helen Keller could ever be a spokesperson for such ideas. So what she comes to understand finally through interviewing other people is that even though, you know, Helen Keller was deaf and blind herself, her whole life, she's been hearing that she is deficient, and she sees herself as a burden to society and all those around her. All her life, she's been hearing that. And you also learn, it's really interesting, she's really good friends with Thomas Edison. And Edison is he's very kind to her, he's very good to her. But for him, it's all about hearing and speech. And he kind of perpetuates this idea that she's deficient, even though he's a good friend of hers. It's amazing how we can hurt each other, right? How we can hurt those we love. Anyway, that's an aside. But another really sad, hurtful thing is that her family, her parents, convince her that. So there's this man, she meets this man and he falls in love with her and she falls in love with him and it's amazing. And he wants to marry her. And she's already in her 30s now. And she's like, okay, you know, I'm going to get married. And her parents are convinced that this man must have an ulterior motive. He can't, how could he possibly love her? How could anyone possibly love her? So here she is again, getting that message that you're not lovable if you have all these disabilities. And so from this, we end up seeing her as an adult still sitting in the lap of Anne Sullivan as if she never really grew up. And this is the myth that we're fed. She was never allowed to fully be herself. And I want to ask the question, how many times are myths created and perpetuated just by repeating them enough times that everyone begins to believe them, especially about the worthiness of some people over others? I mean, God, if there's anything we've learned about myths, myth making over the last few years with Trump as president, boy, have we gotten a big lesson in this, right? But specifically also about the worthiness of some people over others. How often is it deep-seated racism or sexism or any kind of ism, despite our greatest efforts? And how often do we internalize those myths? And how often are we ourselves on the lower rungs of worthiness? So now I want to jump to this week in Torah when Aaron's sons bring an, quote, alien fire. This is how it's translated. It's an alien fire. It's in Hebrew. It is that too. For the sacrifice. And it's defined that way because, or this is the way it's been analyzed, that God did not command it. Therefore, it's alien. It's not supposed to be brought there. And as a result, this shocking, horrible thing happens. They're immediately consumed by fire, by a deadly fire, and they're killed. They are deemed, the message of this being consumed by fire and killed immediately is that they're deemed unworthy of life because of a decision they've made without God's sanctification. Their crime is to think for themselves. I was thinking about the word alien and that the use of the word alien is a problem all by itself, both for biblical times and our times as well, as in the way we as Americans describe undocumented people, as if the earth is not their home as well, as if we have ownership over our land, over our land. Who owns the land? I mean, how do you own land? That's such a capitalist idea. Because really, the earth, the land, nothing belongs to us. None of it belongs to us. We're just visitors on this planet. You know? We're just visitors here. And in fact, it even says that in the Torah. Everything, all of your ownership, anything, you know, that's why we're in a Shemitah. Everything goes back to the land. Everything, leave it alone, and everything goes back, and the Jubilee, everything goes back to its original owner. So we don't really own anything. And yet we use this word alien to describe people who come to our country who don't have documents, as if they're extraterrestrials. Moses' response to his brother's son's death is to chide Aaron for their behavior. He essentially says, see, that's what happens. He takes God's side. He believes they are not worthy of life. Ugh. Aaron's response to his brother is silence. His response all around is silence. And silence can be many things, but I think we can understand Aaron's silence at this moment. Maybe like the stunned silence I described feeling a couple of weeks ago as the war on Ukraine was beginning. Sometimes you're so shocked you can't talk. I was listening to another, I listen to a lot of podcasts. They inspire me. Fresh Air, the NPR Fresh Air podcast. There's this episode a couple of weeks ago called Healing and Heartbreak in a Chicago ER. Highly recommend it. It's really fascinating. And there's this ER doctor who talks about the hierarchy of patients that exists in emergency rooms around the country. There is an actual VIP list. They have different colored paper for people who come in as VIPs. Like, oh, this is an important person. This is a politician, or this is unbelievable. And patients who come in are marked and treated as such if they are, as you know, if applicable. The lives of supposedly very important people are deemed superior to the common folk, especially poor people of color, and the VIPs get the care they need. This ER doctor, he talks about this and he says, though he teaches at a university now and he doesn't have to be working in an ER anymore, he's remained in the ER on the south side of Chicago. He wants to stay in touch with the humanity of the people who live there and who hardly ever get the kind of care they need. He wants to see even the gang members who come in with a gunshot wound as human, as just as human as everyone else. Our healthcare system clearly reflects our society's attitude towards its members. And I say, I don't want to just say citizens. No, all the members of our society, aliens, extraterrestrials, you don't belong here. I wonder how many people would defend God's decision to murder Aaron's two sons on the spot. Would they say that they were deficient, that his sons were deficient in their way of serving God by acting of their own volition? Is that the message of this myth? That those who do that will be silenced by the hierarchical system of this God whose maleness itself is part of the myth? Helen Keller was a victim of her times, obviously. As a person, as a woman with disabilities, she was seen as deficient and burdensome, more so than she would have if she were a man, because women were already seen as deficient. And there are people who still believe that women are deficient. Helen Keller left vaudeville despite her immense talent and people begging her to stay, and she went to work full-time for an organization that was supposed to be a spokesperson for people like her. She became their poster child. As a result, she had to conform to the story that they wanted her to tell of her life. And she told it over and over again. Her new story meant giving up her true story, which included her socialist and feminist beliefs. They told her to shut up. And amazingly and ironically, Keller herself unwittingly ended up co-creating and perpetuating the myth of who she was. This week, Ketanji Brown Jackson, we've been hearing so much about her and the confirmation hearings. The way the Supreme Court Justice nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson has been treated by the GOP, not to mention the silence of the Democrats in defending her, is just more of the same. And the Democrats' silence is not Aaron's kind of silence. It's shameful. All that Jackson is experiencing as a woman, as a Black woman, results from the same societal ills that existed during Helen Keller's time, even if they've changed somewhat. They are trying to silence her. They're giving her a new story. The Torah is full of myths, but that doesn't mean they're based on the kind of world the true God wants. So, will the true God please stand up? And may we be the representatives of that true God with clear sight, hearing, and speech for those in need of our support. May we not be blinded and deafened by the repetition of myths, those told about us and others, and most of all, let us not be dumb or silent. And let us say amen. Thanks for being here with me. See you next week. Thank you.